Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Components. We are continuing our special series on the content operations book. Today, we are talking to Rahel Bailey, who is a content solutions director at TWI. Rahel has 20 years of consulting with major organizations and has long been a thought leader in the content industry. Over the last several years, Rahel has been a leading voice in content operations and content strategy. I'm very excited to have Rahel here with us today to talk about her chapter in the up-and-coming content operations book. Welcome, Rahel. Glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So we are talking about the chapter that you contributed to the content operations book, which is titled Defining Content Operations. So you kind of set the stage. Before we jump into that, though, I'd like to start with just giving you the opportunity to let our audience know a little bit more about who you are and give a little bit more of your background. And then we can jump into talking about the chapter you contributed.
Sure. So I've been around the content industry for, it feels like forever, since the 1989, I think I got into the content business. And it's been a never-ending series of changes. When they say the only constant is change, that's certainly been the case. So we went from typewriters to word processors to big word processors to the web to taking documents and then bursting them into help topics and then flipping that to creating help topics and then aggregating them into a book if needed to everything. Right now it's, you know, Gen AI and conversation design and putting LLM powered chatbots on to customer service, knowledge bases. So I've been through that whole gamut. Somewhere along the line, I decided to go from tech writing into content strategy. And I started using the term content operations probably about 15 years ago. I went back and looked because Dean Barker, who also contributed to the book, had said that he had used that term. And I thought, I wonder if I used that term. And 15 years ago, but I think back then, it was one of those terms that you would say it, but it would kind of go in one ear and out the other. There wasn't really that connection. It's not until things like, you know, DevOps and so on came about that people went, oh, content ops must mean this. So I've been talking about content operations for ages because having been in the content industry as a writer and then as, you know, other things, as my career evolved, I always saw how content people got the short end of the stick. They were the ones that were left copying and pasting because the CMS guys decided to take a shortcut that helped them but didn't help the writer. And I thought, there's got to be a better way. And my ADHD just wouldn't let me sit there and like very blithely copy and paste. So I was always looking for more efficient ways to get better quality content.
That's a great intro. I mean, and I love that there must be a better way, because that is the thing that starts all journeys to progress, is what it really comes down to. So I can attest to the fact that you have been around this space for quite some time, because from my perspective, you have literally been here forever, because I can't remember a time that you weren't involved in this space.
Yes, well, yes, in various capacities. And I like to say that my career was a product of social media, because I started blogging before anyone else was blogging. And I started sharing things like content strategy deliverables. What do they look like? So, you know, I was getting people to contribute and putting this on the blog and sharing. And I think that kind of put me on the map. But I also have that commitment to lifelong learning. And so I'm always learning, like, what's new, what's different? How can we leverage this? How can we make this work for not just the business, but for the content people in the business?
Yeah, and I think you've done a you've contributed a lot to that, and you've done a lot of work in that area that's really pushed the industry forward, which is why it's excellent to have you defining content operations in this book. So can you just give us a little background on how you got involved in the content operations book project?
Quite simply, I was invited by the the managing editor, or the overall editor of the book, who also contributed, Carl Azevia. I got this email one day saying, "Hey, how would you like to be part of this?" And I said, "Well, definitely, because I live and breathe that these days." So I accepted, and I offered to write that defining content operations chapter, because I actually developed a workshop. So I have a workshop that is kind of a day long, but delivered in 2 half days that I would give to clients. But then I also delivered a workshop for the average person who wants to learn about this, and it's delivered through Firehead, firehead.net. And so I said, I've got the material, I can turn this into a chapter easily, because I've had to think about it so deeply to be able to create this workshop that I have a lot of clarity around it, and I did a lot of research around it. And Carlos kind of went, "Yeah, sure, please."
Yeah, I can actually give a little behind the scenes there. So when Carlos, Sarah, and I were first sitting around going, "Should we do this?" And we got a little further down the line, we were like, "Well, who's going to actually define this stuff?" And then we were kind of like, it should probably be Rahel. Can somebody email Rahel?
It's funny when you start to get all the pieces together of how this actually happened in the background, that it's kind of funny.
it was a kind of a funny beginning. And there's probably your backstory as to how you got involved is probably one of the shorter ones, because of how you got brought in, but it's still pretty good. All right, so let's actually get into your chapter. Defining content operations. This is one of the things that really sets the book up and, gets the reader, a place to start thinking about, how it is that we're looking at content operations throughout the course of the rest of the book. So, just give us an introduction to, what you're talking about in your chapter and, what your chapter is really about.
So this kind of came about as an evolution for myself, and that is reflected in the book, I think, because I started kind of going, okay, so what actually do I mean by content operations? So I had to look at what is operations and what is an operating model, and started doing research on operating models, and then what about digital operating, operating models in the digital space. And so we have those things like DevOps and design ops, and there's so many ops that are discussed. And I think we're mostly, we can relate to DevOps, because we as content people have to work with developers often in an agile model, right? So it's like they're doing DevOps of some sort, and then we have to kind of fall into step with what they're doing. So we're all familiar with it, or more familiar than, let's say, AI ops, right? Mm-hmm. Although I suppose we'll get familiar with that too. And so I started off by, what is an operating model, and why, what is the purpose of an operating model? And so, I'm fond of saying you can have two guys moving a couch, they're going to have an operating model, because otherwise it's going to fall down the stairs. And they will with it. So they have one, and it's implicit, right? It's like, you take the front, I'll take the back, you lift, I push, we turn the corner this way, and they have this operating model, but nobody actually says what it is. Mm-hmm. Now, we've had operating models in content for as long as we produce content, because you know who's writing it and what you do and how you hand it off, and so on. It's kind of tied to governance, right? It's like my boss looks at it, and then they sign it off, and they come back, and then I give it to the SME to review, and so on. Now, it doesn't mean that every operating model is a good operating model. And I would say 90% of companies have poor operating models with content. And it's really quite interesting to observe the reactions of people when you talk about operating models, because you can say to them, like, look, if we do this in a different way, you can get so much more efficiency. And they go, well, I don't know if it's worth investing X amount to get that efficiency. And you say, well, you know, we could get like up to 80%. And then they say, oh, no, that can't be possible. You must be fudging the numbers. So we're not going to do it because you're not telling us the truth. And so it becomes a lose-lose situation for content people. And it's because of, you know, a number of factors. Sometimes it's because of fear of change, or it's because they don't want to have to change what they're doing, or they perceive what they may have to change, and so on. So when we look at operating models, I was like, okay, how do we do things more efficiently? So we focus on the efficiency. And you'd say, well, what about the quality? The operating model isn't so much about quality per se. That's handled elsewhere. But needless to say, that if you are not spending all of your time doing rote tasks on multiple files that you have to go and find and remediate and so on, then you have more time to think about the quality, and you have a better way, if you have a better way of operating, you're less likely to introduce mistakes in the first place. And if you go to that, you know, that lean manufacturing, you know, with the Toyota and they would say, well, only 4 parts per million I think it's 4 parts per million are allowed as like a tolerable error rate, because mm-hmm. you standardize everything you do. And so you know where everything is, you know how it goes together, it's, you know, it's very predictable. And so if we do that same thing in content, we are going to have a much better working, when I say working environment, I don't mean, you know, we have nicer coffee in the coffee room. I'm talking about we have less rote tasks and less mind-numbing tasks. And as a result, you're more alert and able to focus on higher value tasks, like making sure that the quality of the content is good and that the integrity of the content is good.
Or, does that make sense? Yeah, I think, or listening to the customer and deciding what it is that they would like to know that you haven't informed them of.
Exactly, exactly. To me, that's part of content quality. Like, are you answering the right questions? Do you have time to go through the logs and find out what people are asking? Well, you know, I can spend my day copying and pasting into 25 file, you know, topics, files, or I can do it once and then I can spend those, that other rest of the day doing those high value things, like making sure my content actually answers the questions that people want to know about.
Yeah, I think that the copying and pasting is the thing that everybody always jumps to, but there's a million different things that content producers do that realistically don't require a lot of thinking. They don't require any like real critical thinking. And the value of content producers, especially when you're talking about people who are developing like self-service content, or, you know, that kind of like reference learning, that kind of content, is about really thinking critically about the problems that are being solved with the content. So when you're able to operationalize and reduce, you know, the simple, mind-numbing, whatever, however you want to call those tasks, and shift more of their time over to the things that, like, frankly, AI can't do, computers can't do, like people have to understand other people and their needs to do, you know, that seems like a really positive and highly productive change, which actually gets me to something.
Well, we've been talking about single sourcing for years. And when you think about single sourcing, what is single sourcing? That's part of a more efficient operating model. So we didn't say content operations, we said single sourcing, which is the thing rather than the concept of a better operating model. And so we've been talking about it in these little pockets for the outcomes that you're talking about. So, you know, this is the means to an end. And so the end can be one of half a dozen things, and everything else is a subset of that. That's my contention. But the idea is that if you can do it better and faster, then that means that you have more time to do those things that are considered, you know, part of the value chain. And, you know, if you ask what the value stream is, the value streams, they will talk about all these different things like design and code and so on. They'll never say content's a value stream, because that's not the mental model of executives, really. And so changing that to say, this is what people consume. This is the product. This is part of the product. And you need to make this part of, it has to be its own value stream. Well, how can I spend time creating that value if I am doing silly rote tasks that a computer could do more easily?
100%. And this is actually good, because I wanted to ask you a follow-up question, which I think is a more specific version of what you're talking about right now. You said that everybody has an operating model. Mm-hmm. No matter what you're doing, there's an operating model that you're operating under. And actually, Sarah O'Keefe, when we had her discussion about her chapter, said the same thing, that, you know, no matter what you're doing, there is an operating model. So when you think about it, in your eyes, what defines a good operating model?
Well, a few things. So one is that you are not doing anything that a computer can do in a few seconds that's going to take you minutes. So, you know, and that can be anything from, here's my standard example. If you ask someone what's their process, they will, and I've done this in many workshops, they'll give you 6 to 8 steps, right? We get a brief, we read the brief, then we write the content, and then we get it reviewed, and then we get it published, and then, you know, 5 steps. Okay, fine. Then when I start breaking down, like, where is all the waste? So it's like, I receive a brief as an attachment to the email, and now I download that attachment, I rename that attachment, I find it on my hard drive, I rename that attachment to the standard that we have, because of course it's never going to be named properly by whoever sends it to you. And then I upload it to SharePoint. And then I look for the emails of all the people I'm supposed to share it with. And then I send them the email. And now I've wasted 20 minutes. That 20 minutes, if I didn't have to be doing all this stuff, I could have saved those 20 minutes. And that's just in one small thing. And those are like 8 steps, and they add up to 20 minutes. Now, if you take that and you look at the entire production chain, you're going to find huge pockets of waste all over the place. And those things, when you add them up cumulatively, I've looked at how we could reduce things by 66% when I did this, basically following someone for a day, finding all of the steps that he took to get something published on the website, and then looking at, if we had a proper system, he would log into here and do this step. And now it's 2 steps instead of these 8 steps. And then he would do this, and he would hit the submit button. It would go to the reviewers instead of these next 12 steps. And then it would do this instead of these 18 steps. And we reduced it from a 30,000 sterling, so pounds, a 30,000 pound publishing cycle to a 10,000 pound publishing cycle. And instead of 18 months, it was 4 months, you know, to kind of like update all of his stuff. So, you know, 18 months, that means if something went wrong on one page, became outdated, it could sit there for up to 17 months. Mm-hmm. And if he had a different operating model, that could have been updated instantaneously with a data feed.
Yeah.
You know, so those are the kinds of things where you can get huge, huge savings, and it's invisible to everyone else outside of content in an organization. They don't realize this is happening. And then, you know, I worked with a company that's now bankrupt because they didn't like what I had to say. And they, shouldn't say it that way. they would not recognize that what they were delivering was mostly content. And as a result, when COVID hit, they couldn't respond really quickly because their content was hard-coded amongst 20 development teams all over the place. It would take us 2 weeks just to find all of the compliance statements that we had. 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had somebody running around for 2 weeks looking for all of them. So when COVID hit, of course, they had to rejig everything. So what did they do? They had 20 development teams working overtime, like 16-hour shifts for 6 weeks. What did that cost them? But they didn't recognize that if they had adopted a more efficient operating model for content, they could have had this done with no overtime, with very little, you know, it's, you just had to write the new content and that was it. It would have been done and dusted. And so when you look at that, you know, they're patting themselves on the back because they only took 6 weeks of the cost of 20 development teams working double shifts for 6 weeks.
Yeah. And I want to plot what I heard there, because I think that, you know, there's two things in what you were saying that are really critical to a good operating model. One is just much more efficient. It's less expensive. It's something that can be done with more with less resources, to a point where you're not doing wasteful things. I think that's really critical. But there was another point in there that I wanted to pull out, which is there's a capability too. Yes. So when you're describing the ability to go and instantly update something and not have something sit out there for 17 months, that's a risk reduction capability. That's a customer satisfaction capability. That's an overall capability that has true business value for an organization. So when people are thinking about content operations, I think it's not just the aspect of being able to do things more efficiently, less expensively. It's also the ability to have critical path capability for certain pieces of content that have high business value or high impact for the customer. And I wanted to grab that out of your definition, because I thought it was really important.